Okay, everybody. I think since we're all used to being here, why don't we start the class with a prayer? Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, we humbly bow before all of you. Divine Mother, great masters, help us to feel your presence this morning, opening our hearts, opening our minds, and showing us the way to find that perfect balance that leads us to our experience of oneness with Thee. Om, peace, Amen. Okay, good. So, the issue with this class is that it is the whole of the spiritual path. Maybe we could say that about every class in some ways. I'm sure I could probably make it true, but literally balancing the heart and mind is precisely what the spiritual path, our spiritual path, is about. And as I was thinking about what thread to pick this up with, because there's so much to be said and felt and learned about it, I realized that the place to start had to be with how we're on this path to begin with. Because Paramahansa Yogananda, who came over here, as you all know, in the 1920s, who was born in the very late 1800s, had a very specific mission. He incarnated at a very particular time, right at the beginning of Dwapar Yuga, this age of energy, this age of where even in many of our lives, if we look at the inventions that have to do with energy, all of the things that have come into being, my life more than some of yours, but some of yours too. I mean, from television and airplanes, which were here before my life, but not by much, and certainly computers and the internet and quantum mechanics and all of what that means. I mean, you can just keep listing things. And there was no accident, of course, to when he was born and to when and why he was sent here. It's very interesting. I was reading a piece that Swamiji wrote, some of which I might read to you. It was actually a talk that he gave in Palo Alto many years ago. But in that talk, he was talking about how certain things are now beginning to happen on a computer that never happened, and he was speaking about that, like this great progress. And I think, boy, it's not that many, 30 years maybe after he gave that talk, and have we come a long way. And Yogananda came in right now, very obviously with great intention on the part of the masters, to be born in Dwapar Yuga at this during this age of energy, and then was sent to the United States. And we all know those stories, but for the sake of continuity, I'm just going to repeat them now. But that beautiful story of Lahiri being called up to the mountains, supposedly at first for work, but then Babaji calling him to go up, and this extraordinary experience he had with Babaji, who manifested a golden palace for him and thereby helped him remember past lives and that they had been together. And then Babaji says to Lahiri, I want you to take Kriya. Somehow take Kriya, start getting it out there again in India too. I mean, to Lahiri, not just, he was not speaking about the West yet, though he did say there will be a disciple who will take this to the West. And again, that wonderful scene where he says, only give it to people who are ready to devote their entire lives to me. And Lahiri says to Babaji, there are so many who need this, who are not yet ready to devote their entire lives to you, to be renunciates in the usual way. And Babaji says to him, basically, through you, God has spoken. Anybody who has an earnest, sincere desire to know God, let them have it. And you can see how that set the tone for what is happening in Ananda right now, which is unique. And this is a community of renunciates, many of whom are married or have families, which was not the meaning of renunciation in those days. So even from the time Lahiri was up in the Himalaya, the way was being created, opened up for Sri Yukteswar, then Master, then Swamiji. Because you can look at even SRF, where, the teachings are the same Master, same teachings, but they do not have communities of householders. They do not have that expanded definition of renunciation. So it's not that they should. They're doing it their way. It's a particular ray of Master's teachings. But all I'm saying is that in 1894, or no, it was way before that, what am I talking about? That's when, that 1894 is the year that Sri Yukteswar went to the Kumbh Mela, and Babaji asked him to write a book that had to do with this coming together of East and West. And he wrote his book then. So it was before then, whatever year it was that Babaji went, that Lahiri went to the Himalaya. I'm not sure when it was. But in the 1800s, you can just see how they knew exactly what was going to happen. And they created a way for it to happen. And then if we sort of fast forward, though again, Sri Yukteswar wrote his book in 1895, The Holy Science, which is much more difficult to absorb and understand for most of us than how Swami Kriyananda, first Yogananda, then Swami Kriyananda, has laid out these teachings. But still, everything's in there for those who have the ability to intuitively almost understand what he was saying. I tried reading that book for years before I could read it, and I think I probably should go back and actually try and read it again now. Just progressing on this path, I think it would mean much more to me. It's the truth with absolutely no fat and written in a particular way that it's difficult to get, but still, it was a book that says, how are Eastern teachings and Western teachings similar, referring to Christ, of course, Christ's teachings, and Babaji's teachings, and how will it all come together? So for 170 years now, at least as far as we know, we can look back and see this happening, see the groundwork being laid for this. Master came over here in 1922 with really his purpose was to clarify the true teachings of Christianity and to awaken that knowing within each of us that these are profound truths. They had not simply to do with Christ, but that Christ's teachings and Krishna's teachings are precisely the same teaching. And again, we can see how that's unfolded. But right from the beginning, even in this experience, this life purpose of bringing East and West together, where India was so much about the heart and soul of things, the intuition, the knowing internally, and the West, again, 1922, early Dwapara, was really much more reason, mind, intellectually driven. Let's see how much we can invent, create a very male-dominated society. Not male as in men, but masculine entity dominated, really unlike India. And with this understanding, that's going to stop in a minute. I think somebody's getting a smoothie. That's what I think that is, I hope. If it doesn't stop soon, we'll go and talk to them. But so here comes Master, who really is going to show us, really to bring to the West, not to Indianize us, but to spiritualize us. That's what he did, to help us begin to understand what is intuition. What role does the heart play? What role does the feminine quality play in finding happiness, in finding truth? Because we really didn't know that. I mean, the best we had here was Christianity and Judaism, really, which were so far away from the original teachings of Christ and of Moses that none of us, other than past life great good karma, were going to be able to figure this out. I mean, we would have had to have that within us, and I think probably those of us who are sitting here did, because we were drawn to this path. But even still, I mean, if you think about it, how could you have read the Bible or the Gita and even begun to understand really what it was saying? I went to, for years and years as a teenager, to something that was called the College of Jewish Studies. It was for some chosen number of people. The Jews were always into choosing people. They themselves felt like they were the chosen people. But they would choose those students who had gone through a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah and ask us if we wanted to go into this college, which of course to a 14-year-old, you can imagine, it sounded great. And it was great. I mean, I don't want to be too glib about it. I studied the Old Testament with rabbis and other Jewish theologians for years. And I can honestly say I have no idea what was really, now I do, but I had no idea what was being said in the Old Testament. The biggest gift that gave me, which is in some ways a very sweet story, but at the age of 19, after being deeply committed to Judaism, insisting that my parents keep a kosher home at least over Passover, otherwise I would threaten to move out, which I frequently did, and went and stayed with my grandmother, who would do that. I was really trying to, in a way, I would say, live by the law, because there are so many laws in Judaism that you're supposed to follow every day, 600 and some of them. I mean, it's, you know, a full-time job trying to live by the law if you want to be a practicing Jew. But when I was 19, and on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, sitting in a synagogue, and it came to me that not only did I not believe anything the rabbi was saying, because he was talking about the Jews being God's chosen people, and I just felt to my, now it sounds so silly, but I was 19, I just knew nothing. I thought, how could this God that I'm seeking have a chosen people? What sense does that make? But the other thing that came to me without words is that I knew I was not feeling inspired. There was no inspiration, which is really, in a way, what we'll wind up talking about today in various ways. But that meant there really wasn't the heart and soul of it. It was what you needed to do to be a quote-unquote good Jew. And I got up and walked out right in the middle of that Yom Kippur service. And which was a big deal, by the way. I mean, nobody walked out in Yom Kippur, certainly not if you were one of the people who had all the eyes on you. But I did, and I think I've been back in a synagogue twice since then to attend somebody's bar mitzvah. And those two times, maybe a couple of weddings, I don't remember. But I always feel the same thing. You know, it's still a very Western mind-driven religion. So we have this Judeo-Christian understanding of everything in the United States. And it was the 1920s. I mean, it just amazes me when I think how perfect it was. You see all of these pictures of Master where he's, you know, where you're looking out into the audience. We get to see it. Thousands of people. Everywhere he went, thousands of people listening to him. In those days, how odd that must have been. They had none of the means of communication that we have. I know when I was 28 years old, and I was down in San Diego, and I had been on a search for a teacher by then, since 19, I was searching. And I went to this conference that Swami Satchitananda was leading, and I was looking, and I was 28, so it was 42 years ago. 42 years, not a lot of years, really. Sounds like a lot, but I had never personally seen a Swami. I'd never seen anybody with that long gray beard and those orange robes. And that was whatever year that was, in the 1970s. So, I mean, can you imagine in the 20s and 30s, without television, without movies, like, we, you know, no movies, no colored film, no nothing, what it must have been like to see Master come. But everybody just knew, all of the people who were drawn to him. And again, it was just, it was in the ether, as he himself said when he was at that garden party. I've read those words at least 100 times, maybe more. They're at our community under the bust of Master, where he says, "My words are planted in the ether." And you think about what that means, but that's what happened with Babaji and with Lahiri and with Sri Yukteswar. They just put that energy out, and that was it. So be it. It was just going to happen. And somehow, these Americans just fell in love with this man, and people listened. And he was able to, although the numbers were not huge. You remember this story where there were, was it 6,000 or 600 people in an audience? I think there might have been 600. I don't want to exaggerate. It could have been 6,000. He certainly spoke to 6,000. But where he said, if we get six or if we get five, was it 500 or 5,000? Do you remember this story? It was 5,000, right? Or are you saying you don't think it was? Even if it was 500. And Dr. Lin said to him, "Look at all these people." And Master looked at him and said, "We'll be lucky if we get five." It must have been 500 because it was with that saying from the Gita. No, 5,000. Out of 1,000, one will search for me. Out of 1,000. It's important to say Master said we have much better odds than that. Those of us who are on the path, we're going to do better than 1 in 1,000. But from that talk, 5 people wound up coming, just like he said. So it's not that everybody was just ready to follow this path of self-realization, but those 5,000 people were exposed to these teachings. They were exposed to his energy. 5 did come, and as we now know, many more came. I mean, here we are, these numbers of years later, with this path that was specifically about bringing heart and mind. It was the first instance, the first inkling of these teachings that we're now studying, trying to live, talking about, the first time that they came to be. Tugs on me. Master started talking then right away about the fact that India had much more to do with heart and soul, that it was much more based on looking for an inner life, not an outer life. He always talked about these qualities of East and West. I'm saying East and West because that's how he came. That's how he was able to teach, is India versus U.S., needing to be balanced. And he said, "I came to spiritualize America, and I will take the best of the United of America back to India," meaning that efficiency, that dedication to getting a job done, that ability to reason and to see what had to happen. Swamiji tells a story in his very early days where he was going to give a talk somewhere. He had been invited by a group of Indians at a medical college to put on a program. But it was specifically for Indians because he had already been to India. And he said, "What should I bring?" They said, "Don't worry, we'll have everything so you can show your slides, and we'll have a projector, and we'll have a microphone." And he said, and he got there, and he said nothing was there. First they'd run out and get the projector, and then it didn't work. Then they'd run and get another one, and then somebody else had to run and get the slide. And he said he just laughed because in those days he said, "I know I'm in India." I mean, it just felt like that to him. In that very sweet way, but that ability that we have to bring it all together, to make it happen. Now we're talking about back in Swami's early days. You know, India's come such, it's just covered so much distance in the last 20 years even. it's hard to describe it. I mean, going back to India, that it's so much of it is unrecognizable or dramatically different. Even then, there was some sophistication in the big cities, but it's very different now and was very different then. And Master was here decades before that. So he was saying, there's a sharing that has to happen here. There's something that has to come together. We have to bring the heart and soul and the reasoning, logical mind together if people want to know God, if that's what people want to do. And really started sharing all of these teachings with us where he was saying, make no mistake about it, it is virtually impossible until you have completely balanced those energies to be able to know God the way each and every one of our souls is yearning to, whether it's conscious or unconscious. That's what our soul's yearning for. That's why that line in our festival, when it says, every week we read those words and a prayer went up in wordless yearning, it's just so beautiful because the soul's not going to speak in words, but that deep desire to know God is happening for everybody. And Master came here and went back to India too, but basically starting to show us the way. So for our path, this is our path. I mean, the coming together of heart and mind is exactly what Master came here to show. And no mistake that it was manifesting on the material plane in the physical world, exactly the teachings that he was trying to bring to us that were much more subtle. Does anybody have any comments or questions before I go on? Can I ask you to hold that question? Because it'll make much more sense. You know, really, you're asking me about the class, and that's perfect. But it is the whole, I mean, because what you're saying, if the physical circumstances don't allow it, that is actually rarely the case. How interesting. Go help somebody else bring heart and mind together. Could you close the door on the way outside, Ganesh, please? I will say to you right now, and I hope that it begins to become clear, that's the mind talking. That I will say to you right now. The mind not only begins to tell us why we can't do things we can't do, but it is so remarkably good at backing up its argument. It's just so incredibly good at it that we're sure, we each do this, I'm not, whatever your circumstance is, I'm not making fun of it, every one of us in this room has to have this same thing, or we would no longer be in our bodies. It's just simply the way it is. That the mind is so good at convincing us. We get that. We understand that it says, I know that's true, but in my circumstance. And then you define your circumstance, which is what Maya is. And it's a hard pill to swallow because life looks so real. And it just, it hurts if we hold ourselves up to this bar that says, in our minds, if I were better, I could do it. If I were better at this spiritual thing, I could do that. But that's simply not the case. There's nothing wrong or bad about where we are. In fact, and this is parenthetical, although it's relevant, but I will just say, the very fact that we're all in this room this morning just says so much about who we are, what we want, what we're looking for in life. And you know, the truth is, God is not listening to our mind. He's watching our heart. He's listening to our heart. And those are not just words. That's a magnetic, physical law of the universe, of all of creation, that God, that what we call God, which is our own highest self, it really simply is. It's the truth of who we are. It lives in our heart. It's not just watching our heart. It is our heart. So whatever we're doing and whatever we might may or may not accomplish in this life, it's not that it doesn't matter. It matters. We want to make all of the spiritual progress that we possibly can in this life. Why have to keep coming back and keep coming back? If we can go from 500,000 more lives to 450,000 by all that we can accomplish in this life, let's do it. I remember this experience I had when I did a very long seclusion once, and realizations kept coming to me that I knew would allow me to come back and change my life in ways that had felt just virtually impossible to me before. But it's, I think, is a part of what happens when we do seclusion. I think it's part of why Master always said seclusion is the price of greatness, because when you are willing and able to go that deep and be alone, things come to you that cannot come to you in any other way. We can't hear them. Our mind's making too much noise. And you get into seclusion, and if you can make it through that first days or week or hours, whatever it is, where your mind's just gibbering so that you can't hear anything, soon you start knowing things. You really do. But I came back, and I remember I said to a friend of mine, you know, I just have this feeling that I just catapulted over 100 lifetimes. It was just the feeling I had. It's the one time in my life where I had a sense of making so much spiritual progress. I could see it. I was changed when I came back. And if, I don't know why I chose 100 lives, who knows, but that's what I said. So I think as we get to the end of this class and we talk about what does it mean to get conscious and alive and real about being on a spiritual path, what does it mean to be on a path? How do we put one foot in front of the other, really? I mean, always loving ourselves and being compassionate with ourselves and never blaming ourselves, that's essential. But we find what little bit of progress can we make? The absolute truth, and this I know from my own experience and from being a, you know, on the path and a spiritual counselor to hundreds and hundreds of people, is that you get down the road a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, and you notice in each of those spots, whenever you stop and look, that you don't really recognize yourself anymore. That you wouldn't know it day by day, but you're making such progress. But it's not the way the mind wants to make progress. Some of you have heard me say this before, but this is worth hearing many times. The work that I do is called transformational medicine. That's my private practice now. So you would think people come to somebody whose card and doorstop says transformational medicine, that they actually want to transform, if people know what that word means. And I'm actually picky about who I'll see. I don't really want to be just seeing everybody who's interested in wallowing in the same stuff. But people come to me, and I very often write prescriptions for people on a prescription pad because people love prescriptions, but they're unusual. There are things like, I mean, there are many things. You have to go away with your partner for an overnight to Carmel, you know, once a month or once every other month. Or somebody will come to me, this happens particularly with women who have been raising families, and they get to be 45, 50 years old, families are gone, they realize they haven't taken care of themselves. Not that men take such great care of themselves, but it happens differently. But often, women are musicians or artists or whatever, and they haven't been creative at all. They just say, I didn't have time. I've had no time. So I write them a prescription that says, once a week, you have to drive up to Skyline, take your charcoal or your colored pencils or whatever you're doing, and sit up there and draw for 1 hour and come back, or go someplace you think is beautiful. You get it. These are prescriptions that are meant to help people's energy start moving. And they'll come back to me in a week or two or three. Did you get out and draw it all? No. Why not? I guess, I don't know, I just didn't do it. Rarely do they have a reason. They learned pretty early on, don't talk to me about not having time, because that's really not a great excuse. And then as they're there, they say, but can you tell me how to change or how to solve this problem? And I said, yeah, draw. No, I mean, can you just give me some, tell me what to do? I'm telling you what to do. Draw. Play your instrument. go away with your partner. I mean, for us, I would say some of that to each one of you probably if I was alone with you, if you came to me, to each and every one of you. I say it to myself. But we also then talk about doing what we're doing this morning. Come to one class a month. Come to one kirtan a month. Meditate 5 minutes if that's all you can do, but start a practice of meditation because you start moving energy. And in a month, you don't recognize yourself, or in 2 months, or in six. It just happens that way. You suddenly find yourself in exactly the same situation you would have been in a year ago. And I promise you this would be true for anybody if we're making effort, spiritual effort. And you think to yourself, my God, I could never, that could never have happened a year ago. It's just whatever the it is for you. I have so many of those stories. Why? Because my energy was stuck. I was not opening my consciousness to the thought of God. I had no idea what it used to mean, God's working through me. I didn't know what it meant to say, Divine Mother, I don't want to do this. I don't want to have this discussion with this person. You come and you do it. You be here. You speak to them. Of course, I'm sitting there, and the words are coming through me. But to remember to do that prayer, you know, this is really all what we're talking about when we talk about heart and mind. I mean, that's not sort of the end of the class in a way, but it doesn't matter. It's exactly what it is. It is the spiritual path. And there's not a human being that it won't work for when we're ready. All we have to do is do it. We don't even have to be enthusiastic about it. And we just have to start. No energy can move if we're standing still. And as I started to say to Deepak, but to all of us, because believe me, I mean, I love listening to this. These are my stories. I lived them. I've told them. I could listen to them over and over because they were given to me for a reason. And just the other day I went for a walk with a woman, a friend, who quoted a story to me that she heard me tell 15 years ago. It was a very powerful story. She said to me, I can tell you honestly 100 times I've used that story in my own life. So they're not just mine. That's what I'm saying. I'm given these experiences because they're meant to be shared, but they're very powerful. Okay, so that's the beginning of the answer. So that was the first thing that came to me, this whole realization that Master laid, this is precisely why he came here, was to show us how to do this. And he did it outwardly so everybody could see that he was doing it, and he included it in every one of his teachings. This really balance of the heart and mind. There's this quote from Patanjali's sutras. This is, you know, thousands of years ago, but it's one of the sutras. It says, just as a pure crystal reflects the true shape and color of objects that are placed before it, so in the yogi's mind, upon the neutralization of his vortices of emotion in the heart, attains complete inner balance. I mean, so it's not as if Master had just had the idea. Master came to teach this because it's Sanatana Dharma. It's an eternal truth. And as Swamiji has said many times, if this world as we knew it were to quit existing tomorrow, which of course has happened many times in history, and we know that, you know, there's been whatever, suddenly the world disappears, and then we're back millions of years later, benefiting from the beautiful islands that were made and whatever else happens, discovering whole civilizations underground, under oceans. So chances are it's going to happen again. Somebody, as soon as there was a somebody, a human being most likely, because that's when that soul has evolved to the point of being able to think and reason and have free will, we only get there when we're a human being. Snails are not behaving in the same way. Fish are not behaving. Trees aren't. Not that they don't feel things, but they feel it at a vibrational level. It's different. For right in those early days of human existence, he says, in the future, somebody will know these truths. So what Patanjali wrote, what Master said, and all of the great avatars have said, it's not like it's going to go anywhere. It's just simply the truth. So then I started realizing and thinking about how these teachings, the balancing of the heart and mind, are made manifest in the very fact that we're born either a man or a woman. And for whatever karmic reasons that that happens, and given that there's no absolute here, and I know that, and you know that, it's not like we could never find somebody who was born into a man's body who does not have a very strong feminine aspect presence, because of course it happens, and vice versa. I mean, I know ways in myself that I've felt all my life to have a strong male, certain strong masculine, I don't want to say male, but masculine qualities. And yet at the same time, you know, I could be a real bhakti, mother, loving, and I hope everybody feels some of that. But the truth is that it's very often accurate that when you come into a male body, you lean more towards male qualities. And when you're born as a woman in this life, that you have more of those qualities. It's just simply the fact. Again, not to say it's absolute. It would be much better if we could all come in perfectly balanced. That's what we're aiming for. But I can't remember where I was last week, but I think it was Biraj. It was with Chidambar in our Sadhaka training group. This is where it came up. And Chidambar, we were talking about devotion. That was the topic of a couple of weeks for the people who are in this training group that we're doing right now. And Chidambar just said, devotion, he never understood the word for the biggest part of this life. He had no idea what Master was talking about or any of us were talking about. He was so male for so much of his life. He said, I simply had to start meditating on and in my heart, like the physical heart, just start doing it. I know many men in classes have asked me very directly, how do you develop devotion? I hear it much more from men. I've heard it from women, but much more from men. And I've said to men at times, sit in front of a chakra chart, we don't happen to have one here, and breathe from your heart to the heart and the chakra. You know, you see these chakras, they're all there. Just breathe from heart to heart, every breath. You breathe in, you take in that, the quality of the heart from there, you breathe out, you share it with that heart. Or start wearing a lot of green, I've told men. Anything that we can do, there's affirmations, there's songs, I'm going to talk about it a little because I'm moving from the obvious, from Master going from India to America, to the more subtle in these teachings. But anything that you can do to draw energy into your heart, if you happen to be somebody who can't feel it. And I don't want to say that it's always women, because yesterday I was sitting with a woman who's been coming to see me a little bit, and she was talking to me about her daughter and her daughter being angry with her. And she said, I think she's right in a way that I haven't been a very good mother because I've been lopsided. She said, I've been very logical, got very good reasoning skills. I'm very practical. She said, and I was practical with her. I would take her here, do this, that. She said, but I'm only just now, she's grown up, and I'm beginning to discover my heart. So it happens, and I think most people just live unaware of that, but you have to begin to become aware, just like women who are just lost in their heart need to find ways to develop some logic. Otherwise, they're just all over the place. I mean, we know what happens if, you know, this, I guess I can't talk about one phase of this without the other, but we really are talking about astral spines and chakras. And if you're just in your heart and it's not balanced with reason, or it's not, and you're not bringing any reason, then you wind up being agitated, emotional. You're somebody who cries at in a moment's notice about anything and everything. Everything feels like it's about you. You take everything very personally. This is what happens to people who are only in their heart but have no idea. I keep reaching up here because I'm reaching to my third eye, but how to balance it with reason. And there's no quality, none of these qualities. It's the very nature of our existence. It's our energetic spine. It's all of who we are, why we are, how we are, that can work in its best possible way if it's not in balance. And all of life is that way. All of the spiritual path is that way. Swamiji had a magnificent image in either a talk or something. I don't know where I got this. He said the spiritual path is like tiny, very thin concentric circles. And on the inside of each of those circles is the inside, the energy that's coming in and heading up towards our third eye. And on the very outside of that is the outward feeling, that those things that are drawing us out into the world, the way we're paying such attention to the physical world. And he said, it's exactly, or like a coin, where, you know, you ask what side of the coin's better, but it's all the same metal. You can't have only one side of a coin. You always have two sides of a coin. You always have two sides of those concentric circles. So it's not like we're trying to get rid of anything, but we're trying to live right in the middle of that, where it's in a place of perfect balance. You know, it's interesting. The answer to all of this, in a way, this aspect of what I'm talking about, is in this play. It's the final act of the play. So if you didn't come to see the play last night, I heard you say you were going tonight, Deepak. But it's a play that Swamiji wrote, Land of Golden Sunshine, and it's so beautifully done. The play is exquisite because it's Swamiji's words, his very words. I just tell you, last year when the play, they did the play last year, but it was about 4 days after I had this major shoulder surgery, so I was watching from home. And I remembered, I thought, yeah, the play was good. It was sort of like that. And last night I said to myself, you were in severe pain and you had so much narcotic on board, you didn't know what you were watching. There's no way I could have appreciated that play, but the play really touched me last night. You'll see when you go. And it really speaks to how hard it is to choose to turn ourselves around and look in. Without making fun of it, really. But what you see in the play is this juxtaposition of this dark, dreary, cold, windy, colorless life. I mean, and it's been staged beautifully, and you'll see. And it's in contrast to golden sunlight, and how hard it is for people to choose land of the golden... What's it called? Land of Golden Sun?
Sunshine.
Land of Golden Sunshine, sorry. Yeah, I got confused with our Operation Golden Palace now. We have too much gold in our lives. Land of Golden Sunshine. And you see it, and it is not to be made fun of, because every one of us are up against that. We can see what would be healing. We can see what would be right. I mean, I don't know where each of you are, but there is no part of me that would have any argument against the fact I just want to go to God. But does my whole life look that way? No, it doesn't. It's embarrassing to say. After 40 years on this path, meditating twice a day, trying, studying, teaching, preaching, does my whole life look that way? No. Why would that be? You know, it really is the nature of the human condition. But the good news is we get to play it all out in a lot of ways. We get to play it out primarily in our relationships. And no matter what our relationships are, as a rule, one person in the relationship, we watch our parents, we're in relationship to our siblings, we have partners. There's a little more male or female quality in one of those people. It's just the way most relationships are. It's rare that you would find two people of strong female quality. Sometimes it's reversed, too. So again, it's not about the sex of the body. It's just really not. But it has to do with these qualities. And we begin to see that unlike the times when I grew up of women's lib, when women were fighting desperately to become men, and I kept thinking, why do they want that? I mean, even when I marched, I was marching in favor of some of that equality and other things I could say, but not to become just more like men. I didn't want that in myself. I didn't want just more male quality. But unfortunately, we lost a lot of women to the women's lib movement who became very imbalanced on that other side. But the realization that we have to find those qualities, and we can often work with each other. We can work with friends or partners in that way and begin to share and balance some of that. I started to say this thing about the heart, because, you know, really the essence of all of this is, what does it mean to go from the fourth chakra to the sixth chakra? That's what we're talking about. We just finished a class on chakras. And just Wednesday night, I was saying to people, you know, the first three chakras really are all wrapped up in our human existence. That's what they are. They have to do with getting us grounded, getting us here, helping us develop fluidity, flexibility, creativity, you know, finding our sense of our own power. And it all has to be directed towards the third eye. And I'm not going to do the whole chakra class again, but I'm just saying that. But when we get to the heart chakra, we're not out of the woods, because at the heart still, and the quality is air, so still something we can measure, still has some physical quality to it. Still at the heart, things could go downward or upward. It's not exactly that logical in the astral spine, but it's the only way we have to speak of it. And when we talk about downward, we're talking about what I was just saying. People being very emotional, either giddy with happiness, or they cry easily, or they take everything very personally. So you see people like that a lot. Something happens in the world and they're yelling at you as if you did it to them. It could be a circumstance, like there's not enough chairs in the room, but they'll feel like something just happened to them when it's not balanced. So what it takes, all of that energy, the commitment, the desire, to just that decision that we make, I'm on this path and I'm staying on it. It doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter at all. It only matters what direction we're heading. And can we say that I know that I'm going to be tested and I'm going to do my best all the time, even if I fail, over and over, because that I'm going to keep coming back. I'm not going to lose track of the fact that I'm on this path. That's the only thing that matters here. Am I going to remember to take the energy in my heart and to direct it up to the point between the eyebrows? And we have techniques for doing that. But besides our techniques, I mean, that's what Hung Sa is. That's what really energization is, teaching us how to move that energy around. And ultimately, and some of you are Kriya Bonds and some of you aren't, but ultimately Kriya is the quintessential technique. It's exactly what Kriya is about. How do we get that energy in our spine and take it where we ultimately want to go? Kriya is about a lot more than that, because it's about learning to do it with joy and enthusiasm and many other things, but still. So that choice about consciously looking to work with the heart's energy such that we can direct it, because masculine qualities, the seat of all those feminine qualities is in the heart chakra. That's where nurturing, caring, serving, being compassionate, considerate, I mean really thoughtful, all of that rests in the heart chakra. Swamiji goes so far as to say, and in this area in our bodies, he says that's why in humans, that's why women's breasts are right here, unlike animals, where they actually have, you know, they have their teats on their lower abdomen. I mean, it's a very different energy. And you look at a dog whose energy is much more focused in their lower chakras, even though they're pretty high beings. So they get happy, they wag their tail. You know, that's not what we do, hopefully. Although maybe some of us in early existence and some of the dancing we did, we were also in essence wagging our tails. But, you know, really, when you think of it, you watch a dog when it's feeling scared or bad, its tail goes right down and, you know, it just closes off this chakra. When it's happy, the tail's up and wagging. And I think, you know, you can see where its energy is. You can see it in us too if you watch people. You can tell a lot about people when you learn to look through the eyes of energy and the soul. But as soon as we make that commitment to take all of those qualities and balance them with the third eye, which is where is the seat of masculine qualities in us. Again, remember, it doesn't matter what sex we were born, but of logic, of reasoning, of getting jobs done. I mean, everything we think of, it being very analytical, those are all male masculine qualities, and that's here. And, you know, that's why you often see a lot of men, all of us, when we're thinking hard about something, we do this. But this is a horrible thing to even make people notice, because I started noticing it, and I wish I didn't, but I'll tell you. A lot of men have chronically furrowed brows because they've spent a lot of time doing that. And it's an interesting thing to see. And again, not 100%, but it happens there. Kenny? It's the prefrontal lobes. It's the prefrontal cortex is what they would say anatomically. Energetically, it's in this area of the third eye, of the spiritual center. It's a chakra. You know, it's part of the sixth chakra. So that's where a lot of masculine quality is. What we're doing is we're raising all of our energy as we work with meditation and, again, other techniques, but primarily and ultimately only meditation, to bring everything up here in a perfect state of balance. So it's not necessarily balanced. In the brain, it's in the prefrontal cortex. But you know, it's tricky because, it is true. Let me just say this. It's not so simple. When we meditate deeply, which is I'm sure what you're talking about, we can literally now record changes in the prefrontal lobe. So we have a huge effect on our ability to, without being fully realized. I mean, if we had to wait till we were fully realized, we'd all be in trouble. But as we meditate, we begin to change the whole neurogenic process of the prefrontal lobe, primarily, other lobes too, but primarily in the prefrontal lobe, where is the seat of a lot of these qualities that I'm talking about. At a physical and anatomical and physiologic level, because our body is nothing more than a physical manifestation of our astral energy. So it's not surprising that we can affect the body by changing our energy, because we all, I've said this so many times this week, and I'm looking at Caitlin because she's with me a lot. She's been in the chakra class and she's been around, but somehow this has come to me. It's not that I never knew it. I've known it for years and years. But I'm realizing, for some reason right now, the importance of it. We are continuously being fooled into believing that we live in a physical world. Every second of our lives, we're being fooled into believing that we live in a physical world. We don't really live in a physical world. We live in a world of energy. But the energy has just been put to vibration. I think everybody here knows that. And therefore, it's made manifest into something physical. And depending on the rate of vibration, it looks like one thing or another. Those chairs are vibrating at a very coarse rate. They become really solid. Your body is made up of exactly the same substrate, exactly the same. It's just vibrating at a different rate. And that difference allows you to sit on it without falling through the chair. When the great masters realize that and they can control their vibration, they can walk through walls, they can be in two places at once, they can levitate, they're no longer heavier than air, they are air. You know, they can walk on water. I mean, literally, we know this, we've seen it. I don't know how many of you have. I've seen so many things in my life now that I would call miracles. But they're not miracles. This is why that wonderful statement of Thich Nhat Hanh, that great Buddhist teacher, where he says miracles are natural. When they are not occurring, something is wrong. Because what we call miracles is the true state of our existence. When we get a glimpse of that, we call it a miracle. To the masters, they're watching us living in this state of Maya and delusion, thinking we're limited by our bodies or by these minds, or that if our minds get better, we're going to be better. Or, you know, when I say it around gross ways, people get it, but it's so gross that it doesn't apply to us, because I hope nobody in this room actually feels that they would be really, really happy if and when they get rich, or find true joy when they get wealthy, or when they get their next bigger home, or four more pairs of shoes, which just thrills a lot of people, or have another child. You know, I've said it before, it's no joke. Couples get unhappy with each other. The good news is when they only go out and buy a car, but sometimes they actually decide to have a child to make themselves feel better. I mean, it happens a lot. Those are gross manifestations of it, but because we actually think our bodies are limited, and we live with that. All of us do. We just do. It doesn't mean it's any different than those other examples of realizing that energy in these forms will not bring us what we need, or that we're limited by it. So we can record what's going on in the brain, but we're recording something that can only happen at an energetic level. Does it make sense what I'm saying? It's really important because it's mostly important because ultimately the only way to get here is by meditation. Now, we can do a lot until then. So when it's hard to meditate, we shouldn't feel discouraged. We can come to classes like this. This is a great thing we're doing, listening to the truth. I remember many, many years ago, before I was living on the East Coast for 5 years, and I was getting miserable there. I thought if I stayed there, I was going to die. I really knew and felt it, that if I stayed on the East Coast, I would get a bad disease and die. And I started telling my partner that, and I knew I needed to leave. I needed to come back to California. And but before that happened, when I was trying to make the decision, I started flying out here once a month. I would make a date with Asha. And this was like in about the year 1999 or something. And she and I would plan it, and I would fly out, and I would spend about 4 or 5 hours one day with her, and then I would fly back. And she said to me one day, "Why are you doing this?" I said to her, "Until I can get out of there, I just need to hear the truth." That's what I said to her. I meant that. You know, I mean, so hearing these truths, no matter what it feels like, it's realigning our energetic spine to some degree. So I'm saying this because, you know, not everybody can sit down and meditate for an hour twice a day or go into it. One of my best friends who's been on this path for almost 40 years is mad at me because I keep talking about these long meditations. And he said, his words to me the other day, he said, "I keep hearing you mention that in like our meetings and different things." Not that I was never, ever suggesting everybody always do 3-hour meditations, but I was saying that I'd like us to all look at whether as a community are we focusing enough on meditation? Are we in a healthy place with it or an unhealthy place? I was asking that question. But by the third time I brought it up, he said to me, "I feel bludgeoned by your saying this to me." That's the word he used, bludgeoned, got my attention, because he can't sit for long meditations. He's been on this path. He is a beautiful soul. I don't want anybody to hear this, like you have to sit for long meditations. But the absolute truth is, when we're looking to find the balance between heart and mind, the end point of that is something that can only happen when our emotions have been completely calmed by reason. And we call that intuition. But that is really, in some ways, the bottom line of all of this. Because true intuition, true knowing truths, means that we are, in that moment, in a superconscious state. We're not in a conscious state. So it's good to have a good mind. It's good to make good decisions. But I'll tell you this. You will not make the best decisions for yourself if you don't take your thoughts and offer them into your heart. You cannot, because intuition and all of those soul qualities, I don't have to mention again, they live here. This is where they live. And as we purify them and spiritualize them, that becomes pure intuition. Pure devotion, what is devotion? It's the absolute pure experience of being in love with God. That's what it is. Our heart chakra and making sure that we're moving, opening the heart, doing what we need to do to open the heart, but in healthy ways. And healthy, I mean spiritually healthy. Not have our heart so wide open that we're not bringing in that effect of reason and calming it. Otherwise, we make decisions based on emotions, and we can never, ever make a wise decision when we're emotional. We cannot. It might happen by happenstance. You might get lucky, but you cannot when you're emotional. If you can't calm your emotions by reason, by bringing mind and those male qualities, I don't want to say intellect because it's not thinking about it, but it's applying. Reason is really the best word. You can't make good decisions for yourself. And you can't make good decisions for yourself if you're just being simply emotional. Because it's all about you. You're living in a state that is completely separate from the divine. You'll make the next decisions like human beings make decisions. That's why we get to come back 10 million times. Literally. That's why we have so many lives. Because we have not yet perfected this balance that allows us to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that something that's coming is real. I just ask you, I won't ask you to raise your hands, but think about whether you've ever had something happen to you in your life, a moment where you could say you knew beyond a doubt, and no matter how many times you tried it on, you didn't look back and wonder or question it or think about it. Have you ever known something beyond a doubt? When you do, if you do, and I'll tell you, you won't even have to think about it if you've had it, because I've had maybe 10 of those in my life. I could tell you right now what they were, but they're not of interest to you. What do you care about what my realizations were? But when they come, it's not just for the moment. It wasn't like, well, it looked like a good idea then. No, it was a good idea. You always know it. Even if the situation changes later, even if it was moving from here to here and it was just perfect, but a year later, you're supposed to move here. That happens. That's following our karmic path. But you never look back and say, that was a bad decision. You know, this is just one really gross example of this, but I was married to a man who, I mean, many people in this area knew him and knew us. We were sort of a big, well-known, energetic couple. He was world-renowned in the field of chemical dependency, and I was doing whatever I was doing. We had a huge presence. In fact, Swami Kriyananda sat at a dinner table with us one night and looked at both of us, and he said to this whole table of 17 people, oh, these are good people here, but I went by the name Sally with him then. He says, Sally and Barry just have so much ego. Maybe they'll get over it someday. And then just everybody at the dinner table just went like, you know, the conversation stopped. And it was, I mean, he said it in his most articulate way. They're just so stuck in their egos. So I'm not saying it was necessary. It was a spiritual life. We were on a path, but boy, we sure hadn't arrived. And he just made sure the whole table knew it. But we were in the world loved. And then something happened in our lives, which is completely unimportant right now, I mean to all of you, but I had to leave him. And I mean, I felt inside I had to leave him. He didn't do anything to me or to us, but. And everybody in his world started trying to convince him that our marriage was a bad thing. We'd been married for almost 20 years. It was a bad thing. They always knew it was a bad thing, now they're saying. We always thought, for whatever reason, you gave her too much power, you did this, she did that. All of a sudden, they started tearing our marriage apart. And one day, I went to him, and he and I, we are soulmates. We are still soulmates, though he died some years ago now. But we were very close always. I mean, I moved into his house the last year of his life to live with him and help him die. Literally, physically, I moved in with him and his wife, and it was beautiful. But, I mean, so nothing was wrong with us. But he was very hurt for a while. And when I went to him and I said to him, you must forgive me. He said, I have. I said, no, you haven't. But you must, because your soul's life depends on it. And what these people are telling you is wrong, Barry. It's very wrong. Our marriage was perfect. And it was exactly what we both needed. And you should never have a second doubt about it, because then you're trusting everything about your intuition that brought you into it. And that's a really, he got it. Fortunately, he got it. Fortunately for both of us. But, you know, sometimes we want to think if something didn't just stay that way, we don't get there and land and be there. Maybe it was wrong. That's not the point. But in those moments, there's a clarity that comes that is so beyond mind. And you know what the mind does. The mind gets all excited about something. Oh, great. Listen, I am certain I'm going to, of all the medical schools I was accepted to, I'm going to go to Stanford. I'm so excited. I feel it inside. It's the right thing. 2 days later, you know, you get accepted somewhere else. Well, wait a minute. Let me look at this maybe, and do I want to live? And no, I'm sure. Then, oh, but what about? That's what the mind does. That's what the mind does to us endlessly. That's not where the soul lives. That's not intuition. So when you reach that place of pure intuition, you know things like that. That's the goal of this spiritual path. And it's not just to have 3 or 5 or 10 experiences of it. It's to live there. It's to absolutely live there. I was just hearing this story the other day about Swamiji, because he lived purely by intuition. I mean, he just, books and music flowed through him. I mean, he will tell you over and over, listen to this talk, you'll hear him say it over and over. How many books did you write? I didn't write any. How many songs? None. In the meantime, 450 pieces of music came through him, 150 books, thousands of exquisite pictures, all these communities. He never claims any of it because he was really doing God's will through his guru. But somebody was telling me the story, or I don't know where I heard it, that he wanted to buy a lamp. And somebody said, oh, I have a great idea. I just saw this store called, like, I don't know what it was, but like Lamps Plus or one of those huge, you know, those huge lighting stores. At that point in the store, I went, oh, dear Lord. Because you walk in there and you just don't know where you are. And I just couldn't imagine Swamiji in there. It is so rajasic in there. It just grabs you and shakes you in horrible ways. Many people can't even walk into them. Swamiji walked right into that store, right to some back corner of the store, picked the lamp that he wanted, and the man said, I can't believe it. That lamp was just delivered here yesterday. It comes from Germany. He said to Swamiji, it's one of the most expensive lamps we have in here. Swamiji says, it's beautiful. It's just what I need. Walked right in, no hesitation. That's what happens when you live with this all the time. Not, wow, I had an experience of it. But having an experience of it's good. But it means that in that moment, you've been able to balance these energies and that divine energy can flow. Okay, I think we ought to take a break. Let's say 10 minutes or so. And if you have any questions right now, hold them. We can start with questions when we come back. Okay, I just wanted to add one more thought to what I was saying. It's repetitive in some ways, but it expands it. and then I'll stop and take some questions, and then we'll move on from there. Here's what I want to say. No matter what we think is happening, and I'm telling you this, I think everybody in this room knows that I went through Stanford Medical School. I mean, I've had rigorous education, training there. I'm not stupid about what goes on in those environments, either the knowledge we need to learn or what the environment feels like. I lived in them. I moved to the East Coast. I taught at Hopkins. I mean, these are the best academic institutions. I'm saying this for a reason, not because I was the best. I'm not an intellectual person, but I wound up there purely for karmic reasons. But I wound up there, and I was able to stay there. So I'm certainly not stupid. What I've come to realize, and what Swamiji is saying over and over, and Master would say, no matter what you think, we never fully understand anything by logic alone. We don't. We cannot, we think that, and we think, and we live in an area right here that probably has as many great minds as anywhere, the highest density of great minds of any place in the world, at least as high. So we come to, you know, worship the brain, I mean, in the intellect in that way. And I'm not against it. And I've never been against bright or intellectual people. I love them. Actually, I think Ananda is filled with them. It's part of the draw here for many of us, I'm sure, is that these people are so bright, and many people at Ananda have been so well educated, and you can have great conversations with them like that. But we never really fully understand anything purely that level. My medicine, the way I practice medicine, has so little to do with what I learned in medical school. Not nothing. I mean, I needed to have an education. But the quality of my medicine is so much more to do with the intuitive understanding that I've brought to it. And no matter what it is, And again, this is another one of those stories, but that's why this story of that documentary, Encounters at the Edge of the World, that I've spoken about many times. I know Caitlin's heard it, and maybe Lisa, I don't know, but it's so amazing. It's a documentary that was put together by Werner Herzog, who's a really well-known, one of the best documentarians on the planet right now. And he went to Antarctica, and he lived up there, and he interviewed a lot of the scientists who were up there working for that period of time. And he was interviewing all of the different scientists, asking them what they're doing. And if you watch it, you'll see the photography is exquisite. People are doing experiments 100 feet under these ice, you know, in caves and glacial water formations below the Earth that you just can't imagine. And it just goes on and on. You know, these are the best scientists of the time who get to go there. It costs how many millions of dollars to keep that lab going, to get people up there. He gets to the final one, and he's interviewing this man. Now, this is some years ago, but he says to this man, what are you doing up here, Dr. So-and-so? He said, I'm here to try and explain neutrinos, to discover a neutrino. I forget his exact word. I haven't watched it for a while. And Werner says to him, well, can you tell us what a neutrino is? And he says, no. That's just the problem. We know that it is, now I know we found smaller particles since then, but at the time it was the smallest particle we knew about. Not that many years ago, you know, the neutrino was it. He said, we know that it is the stuff of what everything is. He said, every word I say, billions of neutrinos move. Nothing on the world could happen without them, but we can't find them. We know it's the force, and the guy's getting worked up like this, and at one point he says to Werner, he says, you know, Werner, we are beginning to think that neutrinos have a world all of their own. And then he stops, and it's very poignant, and he says, we're beginning to think this is God. I mean, this is this physicist, this quantum physicist. It's extraordinary. But they get, and now whatever particle we're down to, whatever quarks or whatever they are. I mean, it's way out of my field. But it dawns on me, because we have a physicist up in Ananda. He wrote the book about yugas that's downstairs. If you ever get a chance to read it, you wouldn't believe it. It's these ages, these periods that go by in cycles of 8, 10, and 12,000 years that are repetitive. But he wrote that book. It reads like a great novel. You just sit down and you just, it's beautiful. This guy's smart, and he's a physicist. And I've listened to him give a lot of talks. But I realize you could have one quark next to another quark, you know, if you could get them side by side. They're still side by side. They're still eons apart. We're talking about attaining a state of realization where you know you are one with everything. And that separation between two quarks that's like nothing, I don't know what the measurement is, it may as well be like the Grand Canyon because they're separate. It's a totally different thing, living in a dualistic understanding, acceptance, reality, than it is coming into a place of unity. It's all the difference in the world. It's the difference between being human or being divine. It's the difference between having a good mind and thinking things through and trying to pay attention in the world and living in your spine where you know things, where you're guided, where you go right to the perfect lamp, where when you hear something, you know it's the truth. And you would do anything in the world to make your life look like that because it's the truth. And when you see the play tonight, you'll see it. When you get to that moment that you realize the truth, you look around you, you go, what are we doing? And again, I'm not somebody who's putting down higher education or I'm not. I mean, one of the greatest joys of my life has been being a physician and even being in medical school. I think I was the only person in my class who loved being in medical school because Master had guided me there. And I just knew I was right where I was meant to be. I just wasn't taking Stanford seriously in the way everybody else was. I was studying and working. But I didn't think those were the most powerful forces in my life. God was the most powerful force in my life. Makes all the difference in the world. You suddenly quit worrying about it. It's just a remarkable difference to realize that we'll never really know anything, that this whole world that we live in and that we pay attention to and that we react to. And again, I still do, of course I do, but I get to speak the truth here right now. Really, it's not what's going to bring us happiness. It's not even what's going to bring us success. We could be much more successful at whatever we wanted to do if we are studying these teachings, meditating, developing our relationship with whatever your spiritual path is, whether it's Ananda, whether it's Swamiji, Master, or another teacher. But it's got to be a pretty high teacher. And part of why I wanted to start with Master is because it is remarkable that we're here and we have a true avatar as our teacher. I mean, how many avatars do we know about? You know, Jesus Christ, and I'm not saying there aren't other fully realized beings on the face of the earth. There are. Some of them are living in caves in places. They're doing things. I know there are people who have really back here with no karma. But most of them are not out teaching. Mostly this happens once every couple thousand years. When we start descending into a place of a dark enough period and we start praying so hard, my God, we really need you. And then that force can't resist us because it's watching our heart. But until then, so here we are with an avatar that we have such access to through Swamiji. And make no mistake about it, Swamiji is not in his body, but he is so accessible to us. If anybody wants to know him, they can. And I was just up in Ananda Village at a Kriyabon retreat with a couple hundred people last weekend, and I'm telling you, and everybody knew it, everybody, Swami Kriyananda was so present there. People came up to me and said, I never met him, but I know him so well. I thought, of course you do. He's here. You could just feel it coming through all of these great disciples of his. I don't mean me. I mean those, some of the very great disciples that he has. But I have to say, I mean, it could be true for anybody. I feel Swamiji, I did know him, but I wasn't one of the people who lived with him from day one. I didn't have that relationship with him. I had, by God's grace, a good amount of time with him and experiences with him, like when he told me I was pure ego. But, you know, some of them weren't that difficult, but they were, you know, many times like that, brief. But, you know, even a moment in the company of a saint can be your raft over oceans of delusion. I took it. I didn't even take offense when he told me I had such a big ego. I came home, I said to Barry, you know what, he's absolutely right. We are so arrogant. But anyway, there you have it. Who has questions? I know you're going to need to leave at some point, Kenny. Do you have questions you want to ask?
Sure. So just looking back on...
When you reach a state of a pure and perfect balance of heart and reason, yes. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, we're talking about... there are ways to develop intuitive faculty, you know, by beginning to practice, and this is a great practice, offering everything to God consciously as much as you can. God, let's sit down and have dinner. We're having dinner together. Let's pray together. Let's go do this experiment. Let's go write this paper. Let's go sit at a computer and solve this problem. I mean, whatever it is, let's go to class now. Okay, Master, come with me. We're going to teach our students. It becomes a practice. And I really mean this. Again, these are stories that I've told. But I began this practice with my husband 15 years ago, where I just decided every time I looked in his eyes, I would see God looking back out at me. And that every time I was with him and doing things like, gee, honey, would you like to go to a car show? You know, some kind of a car show or whatever. Sure, Master, let's go to the car show with Barry. You know, let's do that. And really find ways to just keep God in it. And then soon what starts happening, and I rarely enter a patient's room that I don't remember to say, let's go, Master. Because I'll tell you, he has saved a lot of lives. And I mean that, really. And if I hadn't thought to bring him in, I don't know what would have happened. But soon it starts happening that you're looking at your colleagues or you're looking at your partner or at your children or your parents, and you really do begin to see God in them. You're not practicing it anymore. So we don't have to have developed fully our intuitive faculties. It takes the very great ones to do that. But we can practice it so that more and more and more, every time we remember to stop and say, help me with this answer, what should we do? What do you think? Literally, to say that, we're developing intuition more and more. It takes so little to invite that divine presence into our lives. I think most people, particularly people who are early on the path, but certainly some people who are on a long time, think it's so hard. It's not hard. It's in a moment, just doing it. You know, it doesn't take a lot of time. It takes, first of all, it takes the desire, really the desire to do it. And this is a very interesting point because this is what all of Shankhya philosophy in India, one of the three major philosophies people study for lives, is about. What happens to us that gets us to this place of feeling that we need something different in our lives to the point where we're actually willing to do it, not dabble in it over here and live our lives and be doing everything we love and then jumping into church on Sunday and then wondering why our lives aren't changing. Not like that. I mean, to really say, and not also needing to move into a spiritual community, but to start taking a practice seriously. You have to get to that place first. And that is much more complicated than it looks. People want something wonderful to happen in their lives. But I'll tell you, this is why there's such a drop-off after Med 1. As soon as people realize the only way to transform energy is to put energy in, you need something to transform. So no magic's going to come here. You know, people who like to go to a lot of different kinds of healers, all of which I'm in favor of, naturopaths, homeopaths, even MDs. People come to me with a bad cold. What do they want? They don't want to hear me say, make yourself some chicken soup or miso. You know, you have to miss a couple days' work, rest, this, that. No, they want me to give them a pill. They want an antibiotic to get over it. They want some herbal remedy. They want somebody to touch them and change their energy. They want fast everything. Not just fast food, but fast everything. The spiritual path takes commitment. It's hard. I mean, to really make it work for you. I'm saying the truth. It's simple, as Joseph Goldstein said. It's very simple, but it's not easy. The truths are simple. You could come to the next 10 Saturday classes. You probably won't hear anything new We're always up here saying the same thing, but in different words, sort of couched around a different topic. Spiritual truths are simple. Know God. You know, Lahiri Mahashaya, no matter who came to him, avatar, he was an avatar. No matter what problem you brought to him, he was notorious for this. He would just look at somebody and say, do more Kriya. That was his answer. We really want to have another child. We can't get pregnant. Do more Kriya. Our son needs to go to college. Practice more Kriya. I need a husband, a wife. Practice more Kriya. I need to get over my anger. Do more Kriya. You know, the good news and the sad news is ultimately there's one answer for everything. But, I think the most important thing for people, particularly early on the path, early in that state of consciousness, and I'm well aware you could have been one of the highest saints in your last life, but, you know, people who are just finding these teachings, I'm going to say to you, spend as much time here as you can. Classes, kirtans, holidays when you can, Sunday services. It's impossible to have this appeal to the logical mind, but the more you're around this, you know, Yogananda said, next to God's grace, he said these words, these are not like an approximation or a throwaway line, the most important thing on the spiritual path is the company you keep. And it is really important. It's impossible to stop. I mean, it's great if what you can do is come here an hour a week, come here. But the more that you can be around the community, around these teachings, around people who have devoted their lives to these teachings, who are serious about it, who have already walked away from all of what they could have been or done or had in the world and are living this life. It's not that anybody's, you may not like all those people, you know, and we're all still with our personalities here. There's many things I could say about it, but there's a lot of people here who are genuine about this path, and that affects you, you know? That's like when you're a motorcyclist knowing when you're tired that you want to get in behind a couple of big 18-wheelers because they sort of pull you along. I mean, that's what happens. That's why geese fly in flocks. You know, it's just because you get a lot from those, that energy that's up front. And it's uplifting. It's what I said to Asha when I said, I just want to hear the truth. I need to hear the truth right now. I need to be grounded in that. Then I was going to go back for a month and live in Baltimore and be in a hospital and in my own home and amongst people, none of whom knew what I was seeking. None of them. I couldn't have this. I had this conversation with one of my professional partners. He yearns for it, but he absolutely can't separate himself from his life at all. So it won't be this lifetime. I could talk to him, but I wanted to live it. I had to be in that community. I had to be with people who, in the morning when I would say, oh, I don't want to get out of bed, Shanti, you're leading meditation this morning. You know, there are people waiting on you, counting on you. Or even the mornings when I'm not leading. You know what? You want to leave Tanava over there all by himself? What if nobody else shows up? You go over there. You meditate for the whole community. You know, being around people who pray before they do everything. Just stopping to remember before you eat, before a meeting. We never start a meeting without a prayer. Never. We hardly start a class if there have been a lot of new people here. I might not have prayed. I might have done it some other way. But it just starts changing you. Because you're not going to think your way. See, the tool that you're trying hardest to use right now, and nobody else knows Kenny, but I'll say he's been studying SRF lessons. He's on his way. It's not like he's brand new. He's sincere. I'm not questioning your sincerity. But it's new. And your mind still wants to jump in all the time. He's also very smart. He's working on an MBA at Stanford. I'm just telling you. So he has to be in his head a lot. You know, he does, just like I did when I was in medical school. I mean, maybe everybody in this room did that. The inclination is to want to, how can I solve this heart problem, but with your head? No. Come and be around it. Chanting is a really, really good thing to do. I have a list of things here that I'm going to talk to you about. I just pulled these out of some article that Swamiji wrote, and I thought they're just fun to run through at the end. But I want to, and they're about that. What can I do? You know, and they're important things. The first one just says, don't worry about your faults, Yogananda used to say. Just keep trying. Worry only about this, that you love God enough. God excuses many things when you love him and not very much when you don't. I mean, so when I said start a practice of offering everything to God, because that will find its way into your heart even when your head's arguing. It just does. Well, the answer is really the same, but it's sort of in reverse. I mean, you have to stop, and you have to consciously try and bring that energy up to the point between the eyebrows and let it rest there. You have to offer a question before you meditate. Before you sit down to meditate, you say, here's the question I have. I'd like an answer. You're asking God, for the answer. I mean, it's a much bigger answer, because if somebody's heart, if they're too heart-driven, chances are your lower chakras are also a little wacky. I mean, all of ours are. Again, if our chakras were perfectly wide open, beautiful little lotus blossoms with the energy just soaring up, hitting at our third eye all the time, we wouldn't be in these bodies. But there's a chance that there's stuff for you to consider and think about with your second chakra and your third. All of which is being, every time we talk about a chakra, these vortices of energy, these little whirlpools of energy, really, where things get stuck lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. And as we open them and we let all those things that are stuck just sort of be cleaned in our astral spine, if you will, just flow through. So everybody has it, but often the second chakra will be out of whack and people just really don't understand boundaries, or they're a little... Second chakra is, its element is water, so it's about fluidity, flexibility, creativity, some about intuition. Again, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but I will say, stopping, not just moving ahead, but practicing offering all of your thoughts and feelings up. And there's more that either we could talk about, or even, with Heidi or something. I mean, to talk about how do I get out of that, because I think emotional, there, the two killers here that you can feel are being too intellectual or too emotional. It really makes it hard to make a good decision about much of anything in life if you're being driven by your emotions. Quite frankly, it's just as hard if you're being driven by your intellect. So, there are ways to just practice. But honestly, meditation, if you took Med 1, you've had Hung Sa. Hung Sa is a beautiful and very deep technique for moving energy in the spine. I'd love to think everybody's on their way to Kriya and they're going to get Kriya and practice it. But so many people get Kriya and never practice it. I'd rather they just took Hung Sa and practiced it, because it really does move energy. So if all you could do is sit down 3 times a day and do 5 rounds of Hung Sa, it's going to help you become less emotional. It really will. I mean, these are sort of tried and true. Master always says, our ways of meditation, they're scientific. They can be proven. But we're each our own laboratory. Did I answer your first question, Deepak, at all?
I think it's getting there.
Okay. I mean, if you want to ask it another way, I'm
just curious about the thing you were mentioning.
I think you'll know that. And, sometimes this happens to us. We know what we want. We know it in our mind, or our heart is hungry for it. But either we have other karma that needs to be lived out, and it's important, and we just have to know none of us are perfected saints. So when there's other karma, we just have to do it.
So the delay is natural.
The delay is natural, and the delay towards God realization you're talking about, because we're human beings, because we're not Jivan Muktas, we're not perfected beings. But don't get lost while you're out having to do what we're doing. It was a tremendous karmic thing for me to go to medical school. And make no mistake about it, it's 4 years of medicine and a minimum of 3 years of training. You give your life. When I was in training, I was in that hospital 120 hours every week. In the hospital, awake, working. So what do you think you do with the rest of your life? You can't wait to get anywhere to sleep. I'm saying to you, sometimes we're called out to do these very big things, but I meditated all through medical school. Even though I used to fall asleep in every meditation and training, I did. I never quit sitting. I mean, it's just simply right. And it feels like 10 lifetimes ago to me, medical school. But the thing I'm saying is, whatever's drawing you right now, you have to go back to India, you have to do whatever you're doing. Don't let go of the teachings while you do it. As much as you can, hold on to them and then do what you feel you need to do. It's a big move you're making, so I'm sure you feel really drawn. That's fine, whatever it is that's drawing you. But as you're needing to work that out, just take God with you. You know, that's, I think, the most important thing I could say, and it's not as easy as it sounds because we forget, you know, and the world has, you know, there's a story, there's a man, Dave Arshi. He actually, where do you live in India?
Bangalore.
So you know there's an Ananda Center there, but Dave Arshi is in Pune. He's the man who's probably the worldwide Kriyacharya. He's a deep, deep, beautiful soul. And he lives in Pune now. Dave Arshi, Devarshi. And he's just a beautiful soul. And he told this story once at either a spiritual renewal week or at a Sunday service. I don't know. I was there when he told it. He said, because he used to travel around a lot, the United States, to be giving Kriya everywhere. And he lives in India now, but he lived here. And, you know, every time you fly to the village, he gets on these flights, you have to fly through Vegas. So he'd have these layovers in Vegas. And he was coming home one time, and he said, I have to admit, I was not perfectly in my spine. I was tired. He was just up on it was an SRW, I remember now. He said, so I'm sitting in you know what it's like, anybody ever sit in Vegas waiting for a plane? Those slot machines are going, the consciousness in Las Vegas could be about as low as it gets in the United States. I'm not sure, but anyway, it's, you know, not a place you just want to go and hang out. But he's sitting in the Vegas airport, and he says, Divine Mother, I really need you. I need you to be with me. I need you to show me something. He really felt like he could not bear to get on this plane from Vegas to Sacramento, which is what happened. He gets on the plane. He sits down. The people right behind him he said it was a brand new baby. He could hear from its cry. It was brand new. It means probably it was a couple weeks or something. The baby started screaming the minute they brought him onto the baby onto the plane and screamed for the entire flight. But he said it came to him. And remember, he had prayed in the airport for God to be close to him. So he started talking to that baby in his mind. And he said to the baby, that's right. You scream. Because he realized that baby was probably, he said, really missing God. It had just been born. It's sort of thinking, what happened to me? Here I am stuffed into this little body. You know, everybody wants to hold on to me. They're schlepping me around the universe on these metal jars. What is going on? This soul that was in the state of a soul not that many months ago. And Dave Arshi said, you just keep crying. You keep screaming. They're going to try and shut you up by dangling all these pretty little colored things and mirrors and noise. Don't listen to a word of it. You keep screaming for God. And he said he was so happy just coaching that soul that it really helped him on that flight. That's what happens to all of us. We don't have to be 2 weeks old. They dangle all these fun things in front of us. Pretty homes, clothes, jobs, degrees, honor, you know, everybody bowing at our feet because of some whatever, accomplishment, business. It's all the same. He called them colorful bangles. Don't get fooled, he said. We have to not get fooled. Whatever happens as we go back into our lives after this, we have to say to ourselves, where do I want my mind to be focused as much as possible? Did you ever read the book, The Practice of the Presence of God? Is that Frank Laubach's book? The Practice of the Presence of God, right? You can download it from the internet. It's a little book. You just download it. It's not that many pages. Missionary who went to the Philippines a long time ago. You just watch. He first started praying a few times a day, then every 2 hours, then more and more and more. Then he began a practice of trying to have nothing but God on his mind. That's a practice. Nothing but living from here to here. he succeeded too. I mean, really remarkable. Well, we're not probably, I don't know about anybody else, let me say, I don't have God on my mind every single moment, but I'm trying. I really am trying. And every encounter I have in this church, every person who comes to see me, every time I sit with anybody, Master, what do you want to say to them? What do they need to hear? And what are the words through which they could hear it? I must say that 15 times a day here at work. You know, just constantly calling on that presence so that it's as little of Shanti there as possible. I really mean that. It's an interesting thing. I've been given this huge personality in this life. But it just is out there getting things done and working and saying a lot of words. But as much as possible, I want people to feel like they're near Master when they're near me. Master had a lot of energy too. So I feel like it's okay. You know, he didn't accomplish what he accomplished by just being quiet. Some people are meant to do that. Just sit in the back of the church and meditate. But yeah, so take Master with you. And go and meet Haridas and Romo. The rest of this list? Yeah, let's do these. Okay. Yeah, you can, but it's time for us to do it, even if we wind up. I don't really feel like I need to say a lot more because it's many ways of saying the same thing, but I think, you know, we really get it. This balancing heart and mind, it's a spiritual practice. It's not a practice of logic. And you can't get there logically, and that's what I want to say. It's virtually impossible. Swami just said here, in the West especially, our bias is to think that we can only understand a thing by thinking, by intellectuality. We can only understand a thing from within, by intuition, is the truth. You'll never understand it by reason alone. Reason can only give you a plausible possibility, but it can never be sure if you come to a decision only by reason, which is really what I've been saying. But it's just said so succinctly there. And that I know to be true. That one does not need to be fully realized to have had so many experiences. And the mind's going to keep wanting to jump in because most of our life, that's what we get most of our positive feedback for as youngsters. How smart are you? How well do you do in school? How great is the paper you work? How much do your teachers like you? What do they say? It's all in your mind. I'm watching people now, you know, have three grandchildren. They have no idea, their parents, what my life is about. They're my husband's children who have three grandchildren. But, you know, I've been with them 30-some years, so they're mine. But it's unbelievable watching it. The children have never asked me a question about my life. They come to our home. They stay. Nobody has any idea what my whole life is about. But I'm watching these kids, all of whom are in these special private schools. I mean, three-year-olds, they're paying $22,000 a year, $25,000 a year. And they're already, I mean, by the time they're one and a half or two, they're teaching them their letters and their, I think, my God, what is the rush? Where are they going? Let these kids play. Let them figure out how to create things, how to make things. Play good music, and I have to say, one of them in particular, I mean, they really do, the television's not on, and, you know, the little 5 and 6-year-olds are better at every computer than I am. Fortunately, the 3-year-old hasn't been handed anything electronic yet. But it's just, it's unbelievable what's happening in our society. So, okay, I read you the one that says, don't worry, okay? And he says at the end of that, don't worry about your faults. And I don't know what this is from. Oh, yeah, it's from a chapter. No, this is from the talk that Swamiji gave here. And I forget which year it was. But anyway, he says, you say to her, naughty or good mother, I am your own. Then you will find the inner freedom you've been seeking. Okay? Don't worry about how many times you feel tempted to give up your spiritual search and go back to a worldly life. I mean, this is all Master, by the way, not Swamiji, so it's not from that talk. Master says, as long as you keep one thing, if your love for God is strong enough, everything else, bit by bit, will vanish. Yogananda said, God doesn't watch your faults, he just watches whether you love him. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, so if we start saying once a day, I love you, Master, I love you, Master. You know, there was a monk who had that habit. It's in AY or the path. And he would just sit there constantly, I love you, Master, I love you. That was his silent mantra. And one day, Master just walked right up to him and looked at him and said, I love you too. He just repeated it silently, a mantra, I love you. Believe me, that will open your heart. If you keep practicing that, it gets you out of your mind. Will your mind be taken away? Sure. But you can be, you know, on the New York subway and say that. You know, Master wrote the poem Samadhi on the New York subway. He just stayed on the subway out to the end and back and out to the end, writing that poem, Samadhi, in the New York subway. Isn't that funny? He said, don't ever say I failed, I give up. If you do, you're lost for a lifetime. You can also, if you want, Kenny, take a picture of this page, by the way. Don't think if only I were somebody else, if only the situation were different, if only whatever, he says very sweetly, all these thoughts are about the wonderful, wonderful world of might have been. You know, this is another thought that's come to me recently in a very clear way. If any of you are at next week's Sunday service, I'm going to say this again, because the title of that talk is How Devotees Fall. And, you know, they tell the story of Judas and all of that, but this is what I've come to realize, and it's very meaningful for that discussion, is that our karma is like a suit that's been custom made for us. It fits just us. It could just come up against us and lay down on us perfectly. It doesn't fit anybody else. There's no two people who have the same astral spine. But exactly whatever it is that is happening in your life, without exception, exactly that is precisely what you need to grow spiritually. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter one iota if it's happening to be fun or if it's happening to feel like torture or the hardest test you've ever taken in your life, it's yours. And the only way to grow spiritually is to decide to just, as he said before, just don't turn your back on the path. Even if you've thought about it, even if you don't think you're making great progress, even if you keep trying and right now you don't succeed yet, you keep going. And you can never tell yourself that this is why it takes away the argument of how horrible other people are or how badly you're being treated in the world, or it doesn't matter what it is. You know, it just simply doesn't matter because it's yours, exactly how it came to you. So you can waste all the time in the world you want talking about anybody else or wishing you had somebody else's life. It would be a disaster. And this is exactly why when, you know, people talk to me about their issues all the time. It's my profession and it's my whole life as spiritual director here in Ananda Palo Alto. And so often I think, oh man, if I could just say to them, all you need to do, the solution looks so easy to me. It's so easy. Of course it looks easy to me. It's not my karma. They could turn around and say the same thing to me when I start saying the next time, this person was awful and this is too hard and I don't want to do it. It's my karma. So it's going to be hard for me, easy for everybody else. So don't ever think for a minute that you want to be anybody else. Even that thought takes you off of your path. You need your path. It's exactly what you need to grow. So even when we're in the midst of very difficult situations, to be able to have an experience of gratitude for it, not always easy, but really important. Be practical, he says, accept the world as it is and accept yourself as you are. And that is such a, you know, these things just sound so usual, don't they? But it's so important. That issue of self-acceptance, of, look, this is where I am. I mean, somebody was sobbing in my office yesterday. You know, somebody who got Kriya not that long ago, who can't meditate, who just feeling like, oh my God, here I am, I've let my job take over again and I'm falling back in this way. And I said to him, the first thing is first thing, we are not going to sit here and feel badly about how you've been. We will not. We'll just start where you are and say, is there any way that we can start turning you back towards the light? Any little thing. But we can't sit here and just go, oh, you poor thing, which is often what people come and want. Oh, I'm so sorry you're going through this. It's terrible. It's not helpful for people. I don't mean to be cold or mean because, I mean, I wouldn't be. I couldn't be. But okay, this is where you are. And if you need to cry for a while, I'm here. But then, how are we going to help you? Look back at the light. He says, be like that. Be a hero for God. I think one of the greatest things that Yogananda came to bring was an example of a spiritual hero, bloodied but unbowed. You know, his life was very hard. People were betraying him, suing him, calling him bad names, doing bad things his whole life. An avatar. Can you imagine? How often he used that expression that he was a hero for God. I'm sure he was deeply hurt by the people who betrayed him. How could he not be hurt? He had a tender heart. But at the same time, he said, it's my joy to be hurt. It's my joy to suffer these difficulties because it's one more gift I can give God. These are not easy lessons, but they're remarkable, really. If at the end of life you can reach that point of understanding where you realize that success isn't determined by what you've accomplished, but by having the attitude of total surrender to the divine, then you've won the battle. That is the most important lesson we can learn. It's not by what we accomplish. Because if we were grading ourselves in that way, I think many of us would give ourselves failing grades. It's all about attitude. That's why we're saying, always be thinking, how am I going to draw this energy up? How can I look up? How can I remember? It's this. It's not this. Anytime that we have a negative thought, that we're critical, that we're greedy, that we tell a lie, whatever it is, that we all do. I mean, we all do some of these things. Every time, you know, we're losing ground. And if we're not doing something positive on the path, we're losing ground. We have to just do some little thing. We have to keep our attitude bright. You try it next time somebody mistreats you, to be able to sit there and not react. Not just externally, but not react inside. You know, at them. I mean, I just went through a series of things where so many people were angry at me, vocally, energetically angry with me. And I reacted, it hurt me, and I felt upset by some of it, but I didn't get angry with them. I didn't. And the person who was the harshest with me, I could really sit there, genuinely say, I just kept saying to myself, Shanti, keep your heart wide open. She's hurting. Keep your heart wide open, even though she was saying some very horrible things about me. But I didn't really think they were about me, you know? I just didn't. I mean, it's just like somebody does that, they're in pain. These people who are so arrogant around the world, they're hurting. They don't have a sense of themselves, so they're looking to fill that some other way. These are a bunch of great practices to begin to, I mean, short of saying just meditate, which is the truth, but easier said than done. What do we do on those days when we can't meditate? What about when our mind, you know, I used to keep, I have not had to use this in a long time, so I don't do it, but I used to keep a beautiful book. I always had a book from East West that I would buy and a pen that I loved holding, and it was always at my altar. And I wrote book after book after book of mantra. When I couldn't meditate, and I would do it in Sanskrit because that was comfortable for me, like Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. I don't know how many times in my life I wrote that, and I would make it look pretty on the page, and then I would just repeat it, repeat it, repeat it. All of those books wound up going to India, you know, where they sometimes put them in the ground under, you know, when they're doing an installation of a new, what we call statue, they call a Murti. So they do these, they have these rituals that they do, but for them, they're actually drawing on the presence of that aspect of the divine. So whether it's Ganesha or whatever it is. And I would take those books to India, and they're just buried under it, these beautiful mantras, because my mind wouldn't stop. And so I just write it and write. And you know, writing slows you down. We're not used to that these days. We're used to talking. We're talking into our phone. We're talking into computers. We're typing fast. I mean, to slow down, if you pick up a pen again, really slows you down. I've literally had people come up to me on planes and say, oh my God, you have a pen. People just stop walking up and down the aisle. But it's a great way. So just write mantra if you can't meditate right now. Or write an affirmation. Choose an affirmation that's really good for you and write it. Of course, you're going to be saying it during the day too, but just keep writing it over and over till you become it. And then you'll find you can sit to meditate. Maybe keep some CDs near your altar, you know, so that you can listen to these beautiful chants, Master's chants and Swami's chants. This music is so uplifting. Make sure that you don't put yourself in environments. So in like loud, horrible restaurants or clubs, bars, where the music is meant to just grab you by your lower chakras and keep you there, you know, or make you feel emotional. You leave those places. Who can leave any of those places and feel really calm? There are restaurants that I go to nowadays with friends where I won't stay in one of those really, really noisy places or too hard. And I'm rarely in places that play that kind of music. But still, where I just find myself talking to people while I'm talking, I'm just chanting Hung Sa inside of my spine. That's what I'm doing. Because every single thing that we do in the world, every color that we look at, every food we eat, every sound we listen to, every time we're with our families or friends, if they're not, if their energy's not raised, but everything around us, what kind of furniture do we have in our place? What, all of that affects us because it's all pure energy and so are we. It's just interacting with our energy. We don't exactly know that, but that's what's happening. So choose the colors that you wear. Choose the music that you listen to, the foods that you eat. Just be thoughtful about all those things. These are all ways to balance this energy. It doesn't feel directly about the heart, but it is. If you eat really good food, it changes your chakras. Very important. Okay? Go ahead. You go ahead and go. I think I'm actually going to stop here. So if anybody else has any questions or comments, I don't need to leave. But I feel like it's just the right moment to end here. Anybody else? To end what I'm saying. Anybody else want to ask a question or make a comment? You mean made it dual? Well, our very need to take a human body, from the instant that piece of the soul leaves the greater spirit and latches onto that sperm and ova, we're dual. We now have an I-thou relationship. So you're right. And it's not bad. It's not all bad. It's what we do with it. That's the point. You know, I just read something in the Raja Yoga course where Swamiji was saying, don't forget this and don't make a mistake about it. It was new for me to hear it this way. We need the ego to make spiritual progress. We need that. I mean, that's why human beings can make spiritual progress. We are the first being, the first bit of manifestation of soul, whatever, creature that has an ego like that. And we need it. That's why human beings can make such great spiritual progress, because we can use that ego to make good choices, to take us in the right way. So I don't think duality, as long as we're not perfected souls, we need it. It's what we get to do to bring ourselves from out here, out here, out here, out there, down here, to bring ourselves to here. That's what I think. So it is true. I don't know if I'm speaking to what you're speaking to. If I'm not, say something else. But yes, we live in a world of duality. It happens from the very instant of our inception, conception, literally. It does. From the instant we're conceived, duality, we're away from our home in God. And even in the astral plane, many of us are still not, you know, all astral planes are not equal. They're called lokas in Sanskrit. Different people go to different places. And Swamiji, your master, said, I just read this recently too. It's all relevant, though it's a little scattered, but that there are many very high astral beings who choose to be reborn in the material world rather than in another astral plane, or even to stay there, because in the astral plane it's lovely, whatever they are, colors, sounds, you know, you communicate without words. It's a much more energetically refined world. It's closer to God. But they can't make spiritual progress as well because there's nothing to rub their rough edges off on. So they choose a human birth. Either Swamiji or Master said this, and I'm sure if Swamiji said it, because he got it from Master one way or another. And so some of those beings, that's why there's some very high beings walking around, but they've chosen this plane because being in this world of duality allows them to make progress. So I think the duality is, it's right and it's good, and we need our egos. That's why everything comes down to direction and attitude. And it really does for every one of us. Which direction are we heading? Which direction do we turn to solve our problems? No? And what is our attitude about it? And that is really, I mean, it's just really what's important. You know, I don't know what else to say that we remember. It's attitude and direction. It's not a mistake that we're here. So, yes, we're living in a world of duality. I don't think of it that way. I think of it, but I do think of it, and again, it's linear because our language is linear, but as further along a path, and we are changing our vibration as we go. So, for instance, my birth family, I used to make it a point for years to visit them twice a year. Now I go once every 2 or 3 years because I just can't be near them in the same way. I mean, I could give many examples of that. You know, not going into bars anymore, ever. You know, where I just can't do that. I mean, so I think it's a continuum. I don't separate them, and I don't think they are separate, but it's an energetic continuum. Mm-hmm. And again, I think when I say the more refined our energy is, I don't mean refined in the usual word, but you know, oneness is perfect stillness. And within every cell of our being is that point where we are perfectly resting in stillness, because that is the divine. That is God. But as beings are created and the energy starts literally going out, coming in, and you know, there has to be an equal and opposite reaction. We have to come back to the center. Swamiji was talking about one time about how he has an aversion to the idea of gambling, any kind of gambling. Really, I was just funny, I read that, but I was just thinking, why am I not buying lottery tickets? This is stupid. I've never bought one, ever. And I think, man, I could win 250 million, whatever it is, by the community, you know, this is good. And then I read this thing that he said, and he said, one day he was at a party with his parents, and they wanted him to play, everybody was going to play bridge. And he said, I didn't want to be a bad son or create a scene. And they were playing for a pittance. I don't know, you know, in those days people used to play for nickels or something like that. And he said, but I prayed to God first, help me through this. And he said, at the very end of each game of bridge, he was at zero. At the very end. He said, what is the likelihood of that? You know, it was just, I mean, he said, because I prayed. So I think, you know, whatever those ways that we've found, like his being just couldn't stand the idea of gambling. But whatever it is, we're on a continuum, and we naturally are working our way into this world of more and more and more pure spirit. You know, I've realized this is rather confusing because my two husbands in this life have both had the name Barry, but the Barry that I'm with right now, yeah, it's confusing, yeah. And I've been with him now 32 years, and it's a long time. And we have a very beautiful relationship. But he's not engaged outwardly on a spiritual path. It's very unusual, this relationship and this experience, for somebody who lives as I live. So I have a home in the community. He has a home in Menlo Park. You know, I stay there with him a lot. I mean, I'm not talking about the relationship right now. We've worked it out. It's beautiful. It's karmic and dharmic, and it just works. But there's a lot of rules when I'm over there. You know, and that's pretty much my house. I mean, I'm over there. I have a lot of clothes. I mean, I live in the community, but 3 nights a week, sometimes 4, I'm there. And we don't call it his house. We call it our house. But there's a lot of rules around there. You know, no music. You cannot leave all the bells and whistles on your computer. You silence your computer. You silence your phones. No television. I mean, it goes on and on because I just can't live with that. I just wouldn't go. He knows it. But what I came to realize many years ago is that if I were over there, and I don't know if this is a perfect example because he wouldn't mind if I played the Om CD of Swamiji just chanting Om in the background all the time. I don't think that would bother him. But if I always wanted to be playing our CDs, chants, or always watching videos of these talks, it would be very hard for him. It's not where his energy is. You know, so it's not just one way. We all vibrate in a certain, we vibrate at the frequency that we vibrate at. And for other people, no matter which direction it is, it's going to be challenging. And so, I mean, he does things like works for hours and hours, sometimes days and weeks, on pictures of the masters that I give him. He just went up to the village with me, and I said, oh, take some pictures of all these Murtis of Babaji and this and that. He's just been at home working on all these pictures. I was telling Caitlin this story the other day. I came home really, I said to him, I just need to talk to you. I don't know what's going on. And first I said to him, please know that I know this is karmic for me. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's hard right now. Everybody's yelling at me. Everybody was just yelling at me. And I just needed to talk about it a little. And when I was all done, 45 minutes later, he looks at me, he goes, I, on the other hand, am feeling perfectly calm. Would you like to know why? And I said, yes. And because he's like in motion constantly. He always says, God did not want me to meditate in this lifetime. He always says to me, it was really hard for him to sit still. He said, because I've been working on pictures of Babaji all day. And he showed me these pictures. It was so beautiful. You know, so it's interesting about vibration and energy and mindfulness in that way. But yeah, I think it's a continuum, and I think we just leave all of this behind as we move forward, and, you know, and it feels natural even when it has to be relationships. Because I had some very, very dear friends when I moved into the community. People I've been friends with almost all my life, literally relationships that are nearly 70 years old. And I sort of had to quit seeing a lot of those people, and wasn't, you know, it was painful. But it happens. You know, there's a line right at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, a stanza. I wish I had it here because it's so beautifully written. But it's in the last chapter, like four stanzas from the end or something. But it says, Krishna's speaking to Arjuna, of course, and he says, and know for sure that whenever you forsake a lower dharma for a higher dharma, it means whenever you leave that which you were doing because it felt right and it might have been a very good thing, he refers to it as a dharma, he said, I will be there to relieve you from your responsibility, basically, about whatever. Maybe leaving, I mean, the simplistic way for us would be leaving a relationship or things that we need to do if it's for a higher dharma. But we need to be very clear about that. People can start using that as an excuse. Again, I don't have it here. I wish I could read it. But it just really says, you know, lower dharmas disappear in the face of higher dharmas, and God will be there to guide us. Because ultimately, the one goal that matters in life is finding God. Whenever we can find it, so. Okay. All right? Yeah, thank you all.